I'm really privileged to be working on the introductory chapter for this book with the goal in mind of explaining why gang membership's a problem and what's being done, but more importantly, why it's so hard to do anything about gang prevention in a systematic way. So I'm going to spend most of the time talking about that, and then on what's being done to prevent it, I'm going to go lightly on that and present a framework for engaging communities, empowering them to address their own gang problem. So I think it has a lot of practical application. And then Georgia will talk about programs, and she's quite an expert on that. So that's the way we'll proceed, and then we'll invite questions at the end. There'll be plenty of time, I assure you. I want to show you the best data that we have on the national trend with respect to gang problems in the United States. And here we are referring to the survey of the National Youth Gang Center, the National Youth Gang Survey, I should say, that's now sponsored by the National Gang Center and funded by the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention and the Bureau of Justice Assistance. This is a nationally representative sample, and I just wanted to point out that there are four subsamples. We survey law enforcement agencies in the United States every year and have been since 1996. So I want to show you the data from this survey. What it shows is that going back to 1996, our first nationally representative survey, we see that that was the peak level of gang activity in the United States. And we know from earlier work that wasn't systematic in terms of annual surveys, but what various surveys sponsored by NIJ mainly, what they show is that the gang reported gang activity among the states more than doubled from the period in the 1970s to the 1990s. So the mid-1990s was about the peak in reported gang activity. And you see it dropped to 2001 and has been increasing slowly since, with an increase of about 15% in jurisdictions that report gang activity. We don't impose a definition on jurisdictions because half the states, approximately, have their own definition. So they're going to give you the data that they collect regardless of how you try and change it with a definition. So that's the general pattern. Interestingly, this trend is corroborated by data from the National Victimization Survey, in which students are asked, the school crime supplement of the NCVS. Students are asked, is there gang activity at your school? And those data show a similar trend. From the mid-90s, when 28% of the students said there was gang activity, to about 1999, here similar to the dropping point in the law enforcement survey, when 17% of the students said there was gang activity in their schools. And it's been increasing since, up to 23%, almost to the previous level in mid-90s. So you see the similar trend line. So this is good, independent, but albeit rough approximation of the measures. So it's clear that the gang problem is increasing, but there are other important dimensions to it, and which explains why this book is being developed. In our National Youth Gang Survey, one-third of all, across all of those samples of the respondents reported gang activity in 2008. That's a lot of places, approximately 3,000 places in the United States. And in that student survey, as I said, 23%. So that's about one out of every five schools. And one out of 10 youth say that they belong to a gang almost in the National Longitudinal Survey of Youth. And in areas, high-risk areas, gang activity membership is higher. For example, 17% in Denver, 32% in Rochester, in those high-risk areas. So a lot of kids are joining gangs. They don't tend to stay very long. The majority drop out within a year. except in areas where there are intergenerational gangs. So it's very important to pay attention to gang membership because of these prevalence data. Back to our national youth gang survey, I want to make a point about that, and that is when you look at those subpopulation groups, this is cities over 50,000 here in the top line, and then the next group is suburban counties and then smaller cities under 25,000 and 50,000 population, and then rural counties. So you see a similar trend, except that the trend is much more pronounced in these smaller jurisdictions. Not much has changed in the largest cities. In fact, cities over 250,000 population report gangs every year, and they have for many years. So even though you may see some fluctuation in the outlying areas, gang activity remains a serious problem, and that's in the major cities, and that's where most of the gangs and gang members are located. I want to contrast those two areas, the largest cities and then the smaller areas, suburban, small towns, and rural areas. If we knew how gangs formed, we would be able to engage communities in prevention in those smaller jurisdictions. The gangs are largely intergenerational in some large cities, not all, but particularly in New York and Los Angeles and Chicago and several other cities. Now they're intergenerational, but they've long been intergenerational in those two. So that's a different pattern. The gangs are pretty stable there. But in those smaller areas, they are constantly developing, reforming, disappearing. And so it's hard to identify the gangs, and it's hard to get a handle on what they're doing. If we knew more about how gangs form, that would help us an awful lot. We don't have much research in this area, but we know that they form at school among small groups of alienated, rebellious students that are alienated from school and from their families, and in communities, conflict groups, in public gathering places, play groups often develop into gangs and other groups that are in conflict. So that is something we need to pay attention to in our prevention effort, is where those gangs are forming, and to be able to separate the more persistent gangs from those that are unstable. Only about, this is a rough estimate, very little research, but approximately 1 out of 10 gangs survives. Most of them in those small towns, rural areas, do not have the traction, the conditions, necessary conditions to survive. But I want to contrast that situation with these intergenerational areas such as Los Angeles. Here's brilliant research by Diego V. Hill in a 1993 chapter he wrote on the established gangs, one of the best publications in the history of gang work in my estimation. He describes how kids get into an established gang and become a part of it. And I found these 7 steps in that chapter. So it helps us to understand what we need to do to intervene with prevention and early intervention programs. Just think about this. Where there are established gangs in a community, before a kid gets to middle school where gangs begin to show up, kids in elementary school hear about those gangs in the community. They have a reputation. They're getting a lot of attention. And then when the kid arrives at middle school, he sees them and it validates their existence. Oh, they're for real. I need to pay attention. Well, there are other cliques that the kid must cope with at school. And if this particular kid is vulnerable from family problems and alienated from the family and the school, then they're more likely to be drawn to a clique that can offer them some comfort and protection. So when intergroup conflicts increase at school, then the kid notices that the gang seems to provide some protection. Then Diego V. Hill points out that maybe it's casual associations, a chance bonding. Say the kid's walking home from school and the gang members are about to do some shoplifting and he's been kind of hanging out with them on the schoolyard. So they say, oh, come on along, come on along. And then he's become involved in criminal activity with the gang, and some bonding begins to take place. So fearing other groups in the schoolyard and in the community, and then feeling this bond, then initiation is not far away for a lot of kids. So that's kind of a natural process. So we have to think about how to intervene in those steps to break that cycle. Not an easy thing in those established areas, particularly because the gangs offer a lot of attractions. Here are the major ones from the National Gang Resistance Education and Training Evaluation by Finn Espenson and colleagues mainly, and also from the Rochester study. For protection is a main reason, just illustrating the point I just made there in that seven-step process. But it's often a social event. There are several indicators that gangs are primarily a social attraction. Family members or friends are already in the gang, fun, other social reasons, be around girls, be around boys, develop an identity, get some respect, maybe an opportunity to make money. That's not as prominent as the media often suggests. It's usually a social kind of event. And gang joining is a very gradual thing. And Ron Huff discovered this in a Ohio study, that it may take a couple of years before a kid actually joins. So it's a gradual process of association. And it turns out in new research that about half of the kids who display signs or hang out a bit with gang members or wear their colors never join. So that makes it all the more difficult to identify those that are bona fide gangs from those that aren't. And this is important because there are very serious consequences to gang joining. This attraction that the gang holds for kids is like a mirage where there are serious gangs. Increased involvement in violence, a cascading series of difficulties over the life course, coming from the Rochester longitudinal study, beginning with dropout, and then unemployment, drug use and abuse, and difficulties all throughout the life course. A greater risk of violent victimization. The kids who join gangs are ordinarily involved in a bit of delinquency when they join, but when they join, their level of delinquency and violence increases two or three times and then continues while they're in the gang and then decreases after they drop out of the gang. So that's both discouraging and encouraging. Discouraging in the sense that we can expect violence when those serious gangs are present, and it's something that binds the kids together. The gang reinforces the violence. It's encouraging from the standpoint that they can be pulled out, because the majority, overwhelming majority, don't stay more than 2 years. As I said, about half drop out in the first year. So they can be pulled out. So that gives us some source of encouragement. The other reasons that it's so important to look at these consequences is that over the delinquent career, those with six or more offenses over their lifetime cost society and victims between $4.2 and $7.2 million in cost. We're talking about total criminal justice system cost to victims, and knifed off productivity of the individuals themselves. So if they have a career in crime, that is the average cost. But it may be higher for gang members because they're more active. They're more violent than non-gang serious violent chronic delinquents. So we're on the right track here. We need early interventions that target high-risk youth. These can really have a high payoff if they are effective and if we can succeed in intervening early. So that's quite a challenge to this group. As to how communities are addressing this problem, I want to just show you one example here, this broad framework that I mentioned earlier, this comprehensive gang prevention, intervention, and suppression model that OJJDP has developed, beginning with a national assessment of gang problems and programs back in 1987. And out of that research and development work evolved this comprehensive gang model. It encourages prevention to reduce those that join the gang, intervention to remove active members from the gang with outreach work, and suppression to target the more violent gangs and gang members. So you need to map all of the gangs that are in the community and target them with five strategies that are essential to the comprehensive gang model, beginning with mobilization, organizational change, targeting, and so on. One way of thinking about this is to look at the windows of opportunity in the community to intervene. This is not something I made up. This is what the research shows, that among those kids who later join a gang, that developmental process begins way back here in the family, in dysfunctional families, and are evident in conduct problems. And then the kid goes to school, and these kids are more likely to have problems in school and elementary school failure. Then the peer group kicks in, and involvement in delinquency. So the child is on a pathway, on a trajectory of worsening behavior that is kicked off by a troubled, dysfunctional family, and then the problem becomes exacerbated at school and in the community. And the kid is meanwhile increasingly involved in delinquency, and that's why the kid in the seven steps was more attracted to the gang than you might otherwise expect. So it's going to take a continuum of prevention programs to reduce the number that are becoming higher risk and at greater likelihood of joining a gang, intervention with them, the high-risk kids, and also gang members to try and pull them out of the gang, and then suppression working hand-in-hand with prevention and intervention, because they need a lot of control in their lives among those who are involved in gangs because they've had very little. And so suppression can be very effective, as we've seen in the research on the comprehensive gang model. So what to do? First thing to do is to conduct your own assessment of your gang problem. Don't pay any attention to what the media say about gangs coming out of LA or Chicago and migrating all over the country and setting up drug trafficking operations. That happens sometimes, of course, but it's not the predominant matter, the way that gangs develop. They primarily are homegrown. They grow in these conditions I've just described of dysfunctional families, schools that are ineffective in alienating kids. It's helpful to start with a practical definition because if you use a media guide, you'll be looking for all types of gangs, and you're not may not be sure what you're looking for. But look for those, you look for those youthful groups and see how they're connected to the older street gangs. And this definition is very simple and very useful. But you need to reach consensus as to how your community is going to define a gang and how you're going to use that definition to guide your assessment. And then this is the next important part of that assessment. You need to identify the target groups for prevention, intervention, and suppression. So you're looking for the youth with elevated risk factors for gang joining, and the gang-involved offenders for intervention, and the violent gangs and violent chronic offenders for suppression. And you also want to find out where they are active, the main locations where the gangs are active. Is it around the schools or other community settings? What are the gang crime hotspots, the frequency and types of crimes that are being committed that need to be targeted by your juvenile justice and criminal justice system? So the identification of those groups should come out of the assessment that you conduct. Then you've determined your own gang problem, and now you're ready to develop a continuum of interventions. And this is a very simple one that Phelan Wyrick at OJP developed, that's been adopted in the Project Safe Neighborhoods model, beginning with primary prevention, working with all youth, and then secondary prevention with high-risk youth, and then intervention team with outreach, working with the gang-involved youth, and then targeted suppression on the violent and chronic offenders. So if you're working on all these fronts at the same time, then you have a much better chance of giving prevention a chance to work. You need to take the pressure off of the organizations in the community by targeting your resources better in those areas where the gang problems are most prevalent. Two in particular are the family setting. You already knew that from the research I showed you earlier. The markers, we would say, early childhood aggression and disruptive behaviors. That's indicated in the longitudinal studies. As young as age 10 or thereabouts, kids who become aggressive on the streets and with others are at higher risk, and they come from the most dysfunctional families, and indicated especially by poor parental supervision and control. So that is one setting where you want to target your resources. Again, thinking about that developmental process that I laid out. Then the school setting comes into play next. And the best markers there we're seeing from more recent studies are those difficult schools identified in a French study. They characterize them as difficult schools with a small cadre of highly rebellious students who are alienated from their parents and families and alienated from school, and they're suspended and expelled often, put out on the street and without alternative programs. What do you think's going to happen? Duh. It's a no-brainer if there are gangs in the community and if their conflict develops among these groups. So those are key conditions. Finally, these are the key features of the most successful comprehensive gang initiatives using this comprehensive gang model and other studies. What the research is cumulatively showing is that community-wide initiatives with broad community involvement in the planning and delivery of interventions, including tying your delinquency prevention programs together with your gang programs. Rely on them to do the heavy lifting early on to reduce delinquency and reduce the risk factors among kids in the community. And then outreach support and services coordinated by an intervention team. That is really key for working with the active gang members. We have these resources online at the National Gang Center. Here's the URL. You don't need to start from scratch. Here's the guide to assessing your community's youth gang problem. And here's the planning and implementation manual, best practices, experience with the comprehensive gang model, and summary of the research is there in this best practices guide. And we have a strategic planning tool online that Georgia is going to talk about to help enable you to go through these steps. So you don't have to start from scratch, and the only paper you'll generate will be assessment profiles you bring to your meetings and in your continuum building work as well. It's a framework. It's not a panacea. It's not a magic bullet, but it's a strategic planning framework that communities have benefited from a lot. Thank you.